You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Okay.
Oh, look, you've got a copy of Hillbilly Elegy in your shrine. Oh, those are fake candles. I always thought those were real flames coming from your votive candles.
Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't.
Oh, is this a comment on J.D. Vance then? Is your devotion less than organic?
Is it? No. I was looking for the previous episode where I had a shrine to J.D. Vance, Bob, because I want us to wallow in how wrong you were when I months ago predicted that J.D. Vance would do well and you said he was toast. I believe there was some phrase like that. You said he was finished. Through, and yeah, I said,
Mickey,
no, he has incredible
talent. In fairness, that's when I thought Trump was going to endorse him rather than J.D. Mandel, who Trump endorsed at the last, or actually JP/J.D. Mandel, who Trump endorsed at the last minute. So the curse of Trump actually fell on the opponent.
I think that's an example of where, even though Trump fucked it up, and he didn't really fuck it up,
That was close to a Biden moment.
Vance's talent shone through. I don't think the Trump misstatement of Vance's name is the name of his opponent, which wasn't even in the state. It was in another state. He was just recalling the previous, what had happened in Ohio. I don't think
Well, you know what? You want to hear Mandel. My other excuses? You want to hear my? I was kidding about that. I was just ribbing you, Mickey, because Trump had a Biden moment.
Okay. Well, I have,
But the
I'm not rested, so I have no sense of humor.
I am rested for the first time in months. It's a wonderful feeling, folks. I have other excuses. Okay. One is I didn't realize quite how much money Peter Thiel was going to throw in. This is the most that's ever been thrown into a Senate primary. What was it, 15 million or something? Just crazy quantities of cash.
I think it was 13 million. It was 10 million, then he put in some more. 1 million more. I think it was maybe 11 million. Anyway, he was 11 to 13. But Mandel had more money.
Also, I thought But
Mandel had more money on his side. So the fact that all of Vance's money came from Peter Thiel doesn't detract from the fact that there was more money against him than for him.
Well, then let's move on to my next excuse, if you're going to be like that about it. My next excuse is that I thought by win, you meant like get 50% or more of the vote. I didn't know. I'm not up on primary rules. Who knew you could win with what did you get, 32%? And he's the winner? They don't have to have a runoff.
He won pretty decisively.
Is this, what is this, communist China?
He came in 10 points ahead of the next guy.
What?
He came in 10 points ahead of the next guy, so.
Did you see Karl
Rove? Decisive.
In a
field with five credible candidates.
Did you see Karl Rove's dismissal of the Trump effect here?
Yeah, I thought that was sort of pathetic because...
He made
one good point. He made one good point. It was pathetic in that he knows that if Vance and people like Vance take control of the Republican Party, he is toast. Because he is for immigration amnesty. He spent his entire career pushing the Bushes for immigration amnesty. He failed miserably. He destroyed Bush's presidency and screw him, okay? And he was completely wrong. He was embarrassingly wrong in the Romney race where they had to haul him crying from the Fox studios practically. Screw Rove, but he made one very good point, which is when Trump endorses somebody, he's in a five candidate field, he pleases that guy's 32%, but he pisses off everybody else. So it wouldn't necessarily help Vance in the general election if those other 60% or so stay home. I don't think that's how it works. I think they're Republicans. I think they'll vote for Vance. I think Vance will do what it takes to keep them on his side. But Vance has what we call a delicate balancing act because I just realized it's not enough to please Trump to get the endorsement in the primary. He has to keep pleasing him until the election because Trump could do something crazy like saying, well, I don't like J.D. Vance anymore, and half of the Republicans stay home. So yet he has to appeal to moderates and Democratic populace at the same time. But the Democratic populace is easy to do. I mean, his populism is completely tailored to winning over a large chunk of
he's got an opponent, Tim Ryan.
Vote in Ohio.
Tim Ryan has pretty solid credentials in that field.
So Ryan will win at least half the Democrat vote, but if he loses the other half, then he's lost the race. So
we'll see. Just to revisit Rove's argument from a slightly different angle, the point, which was kind of new to me, I mean, I hadn't thought about it. So before there was a combination of Trump endorsement, and I guess as a result of that, another wave of Peter Thiel money. The combined effect of that was to move J.D. Vance from like 24% to 32%. So Rove's point is, you know, 8% can be attributed to Trump plus the money. And meanwhile, 68% of the Republican electorate is completely unmoved. Trump just doesn't have, you know, that's not to say that they hate Trump or that this will alienate them. He just doesn't move them in a very big way.
I think that point was right, that Trump's effect was limited and it took place after Vance on his own had gotten 23 or 24% of the vote, which is pretty substantial. You know, that's what the second place finisher got on his own. Trump had an 8% effect after Vance had surged from being down in the polls to 24% on the strength largely of his immigration message and his debate performances. There were some other factors too, but I don't think the extra Thiel money was that important. But the Trump, the question is, would Vance have won if Trump had endorsed nobody? That's the interesting question. And I think he probably would have. I mean, he probably would have lost if Trump had endorsed Mandel.
Well, he was behind before Trump endorsed him. You know, Trump did give him a bump.
He had an up arrow. He was at 24% and he was on the way up.
Well, anyway, Tim Ryan immediately set in with the message that unlike J.D. Vance, he didn't run away from Ohio to Silicon Valley and New York and wherever else to make a lot of money. He's an Ohio kid. He was a high school football star in Ohio. I think he's got a pretty solid, you know, credentials. I don't think Ryan is great, campaigner. I didn't think he did great in the Democratic presidential debates, but I wouldn't count him out as a lot of people, I think.
Was he even in the Democratic presidential debates?
Well, that's what I mean. He didn't really leave a lasting impression on a lot of people. No, I think he was. Maybe I'm deeply confused, but remember back when they had to have two separate nights of debates?
Yeah, no, I understand. That would have been the stage. Yeah, it's possible.
He's
a pretty strong Democratic candidate, but he's running in a horrible year for Democratic candidates.
God knows, yes.
In a state that is turning red.
Now, the good news...
That Trump has turned red.
The good news for anti-Trumpers whenever a Trump-backed candidate wins a primary is now, if he loses the general, then people blame Trump. That's your guy who lost. So we'll see.
Well, there'll be opportunities to blame Trump also, before then if Oz loses in Pennsylvania, which is entirely possible. I mean, he voted in Turkey in 2018.
I saw that video.
And McCormick is, you know, I don't like him because he's a Goldman Sachs candidate with a Goldman Sachs wife, and I'm deeply suspicious, but he has to be an effective, effective debater. Maybe, Oz has to be too, but McCormick will have a lot of money behind him. And I think, you know, right now it's tied basically 18 to 16 or something. So if he loses that in a couple of other races, then he won't be such a kingmaker after all.
I still don't consider J.D. Vance a great candidate. He seems like a super obvious panderer. And you shave that beard and he's completely toast. I'm telling you, do not shave the beard, J.D. Vance.
He has no beard. He has no beard on the photo of his best-selling book, Bob. It didn't hold
him
back.
Would you vote for that guy?
I've talked to him. He seems like a reasonable guy. He takes ideas seriously. If you look at it, the pattern of his so-called pandering, he does an extreme sort of dramatic rendition of his populist talking points, but he doesn't do anything that seriously will screw him up later. Like, he didn't say the January 6th rioters were right, and you know, he said they were political prisoners, which is, you know, you could interpret various different ways. But he, basically, they're throwing the book at them for, you know, you attack a comedian on the stage of the Hollywood Bowl, you only get a misdemeanor, and you walk, you're waved by guards into the Capitol and mill around for a bit, and you know, I don't know if those people got felonies, but I think some of them did.
I think the mill arounders didn't get into too much trouble. They're not doing a lot. The sentences don't seem to me like they've been really extreme by and large.
A couple of them did, but I agree with you. But anyway, it's a defensible point, and he wasn't saying Trump won the election.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so he hasn't really gone 100% for the crazy Trump, and he just this is a sort of amped up version of of the standard. He's on your side in Ukraine, so instead of saying this isn't worth risking a nuclear war over, he says I don't care what happens in Ukraine. Okay, that was a hyperbolic way of stating the Bob Wright position. So I can't hold that against him.
No, it's not. It's not substantively anything like the Bob Wright position. It's him being a complete isolationist and saying, America, what happens beyond our borders doesn't matter. Screw him. I don't care.
I think he elaborated on it later.
Well, he better said elaborate a hell of a lot to neutralize that.
Your point of view has nothing to do with the fact that Ukraine is not a vital American interest?
First of all, what's happening isn't even good for the Ukrainians, okay? You don't have to say, I don't care about the Ukrainians to think that we're on a bad path there and we should have tried to prevent this war and we should be trying to bring it to an end.
Right, but if you don't want to hinge it all on what's good for the Ukrainians, you can say, I don't want this war because it's not in America's vital interest. We have other things that are more important. You're rejecting allies right and left, Bob.
No, I mean, it's fine if we agree on this and on what should happen. But the philosophy behind it is not, I'm sure, at all the same as mine. At least, and if it is, he can't admit to it in this election.
I very much doubt he's an isolationist.
Nobody's a true isolationist. Nobody's a true isolationist. But well, but the kind of the Trumpists are as close as you can come. Because they are not, I mean, usually the best defense against the claim that you're an isolationist for at least people on the right is, no, I'm for thoroughgoing economic engagement with the world. But people on the Trumpist right really aren't even that. So they are as close as it comes to being isolationist. They're kind of overtly anti-international governance. They don't want much U.S. involvement in international bodies. Vance is as close as you get to a true isolationist.
He is probably pretty much, and you know, he's not for autarky, but he is for economic, probably more disengagement than most. Yeah. But he's a fucking Marine, Bob. I mean, he's not in favor of military isolation from the world. He knows firsthand the consequences of bad military decisions, but I very much doubt that he's a Charles Lindbergh America firster. Anyway, time will tell.
I'm just saying he's as close as you come these days to a true isolationist.
I mean, John Chait is saying he's a horrible authoritarian fascist who has to be resisted. I think he'll be a great senator because he will turn out to be a thoughtful person on the populist right. We'll see who's right if he wins.
The other big factor that emerged this week relevant to the November elections would be Roe versus Wade. So
Other factors, but yes.
Well, what did you want to review, more primary elections or what?
No, that's the other big one if you're focused on the election.
Well, we could jump to Ukraine if you want. We should definitely talk about Roe versus Wade.
Obvious one.
What was?
Yeah, Ukraine. But let's talk about. We can talk about Roe.
I'm curious what your theory is on the leak. I guess most people are thinking it was a leak from the right.
The first
to shore up some supposedly straying
lot of people on the right think that too, having now read the opinion on a sort of speed read, semi-speed read. I'm now going back to the main chance, which is it's somebody on the left who just wants to start a backlash and start the backlash a month ahead of time to help the Democrats and in the hopes of stopping it. Because the opinion, I figured the opinion would be like a strident first draft filled, you know, filled with things that Kavanaugh and Barrett might object to, because they, and it's not. It does say that Roe was egregious. So there's a little bit of venom there that they might want to tone down. But it goes out of its way. It's already sanded off a lot of the potential rough edges. It goes out of its way to say, no, we're not. This doesn't mean we're going to go down the line of gay marriage and interracial marriage and contraceptive use and the right to privacy and strike all those things down, because those don't involve another potential life. Now, of course, contraception does. He sort of glides over that.
So wait, let me be clear, because I didn't read the opinion. So it does not threaten the idea of a right to privacy as somehow emanating from the Constitution?
It doesn't spend a lot of time on that. It says it's based on a right to privacy, which isn't mentioned in the Constitution. It does not spend a lot of time, striking down the emanations of the penumbra that produced the right to privacy in the first place. And it has a 5-part test for, and it sort of states, you know, nothing in this opinion should threaten any of these other cases, and it states that there's a sharp line between this case and the other privacy cases because they don't involve a potential human life, as you say, ignoring the some of the contraceptions do involve a potential human life, but Mike Kinsley's point is you know, if you stop people from having sex, you stop the potential human life too. So, none of them involve, some of the contraceptive things involve a fertilized egg. So you could conceivably, but it sort of vaguely casts shade on them, but does not attack their fundamental underpinnings. And then it has like a 5-part test for whether you should overturn a precedent. You know, is the decision stupid? Is the rule working out? Is it infringing in other cases? Have people relied on it for decades and shaped their entire lives around it? So we'd be pulling out the rug from under them. And on most of those tests, most of those precedents do pretty well. So
is it almost written to prevent people from reading it and saying, oh, this is a threat to gay marriage?
Yes, correct. And so that's why I think that Barrett and Kavanaugh are probably already on board. So the idea that they can be wooed away from this easily, from this opinion, is sort of less than I thought. And the sort of, I don't know, the sort of person that would leak these days is not somebody on the right, I don't think. I mean, they're
wait a second, uptight, repeat that. People on the right don't leak?
They're uptight federalists, you know? The liberals The liberals are culture warriors who want to destroy the very idea of the Supreme Court, not without reason, but because of opinions like Roe. But I don't know. That's where I'm putting my money. We'll see.
It could be. I don't know. So what do you think? Your view had been that a clear overturning of Roe, which this would be, notwithstanding what you just said, helps the Democrats politically.
That it definitely helps the Democrats. Does it help a lot? And is it the salvation for the Democrats in the midterms? I've now read enough articles saying, no, it's not, to think that, you know, what I'm clear on is once it gets down to the state legislatures, if it happens that it's sent back to the state legislatures or in Congress, obviously there's going to be an attempt at national legislation, but it probably there's not a 60-vote margin either way, so it'll stay in the states for a while. The Democrats have a huge advantage because they can say, we want this legislation to legalize, you know, abortion in the first trimester or maybe longer, and the Republicans will have to either abandon their position or lose elections. Because it'll be, you know, in terms of local issues, it's going to be one of the number one issues. In terms of national issues, when you have inflation and a war going on, it's not at all clear that it has that much salience. That, it's sort of an issue you can afford to hinge your vote on in prosperous peacetime. But in the Biden presidency, there are other more important fish to fry. So I'm not sure it makes that much, in immigration, of course, not sure it makes that much difference in this national election. It will eventually rebound to the Democrats' favor.
I guess one question is, where is the pro-choice energy directed in the wake of this? Is it more at the level of state houses, and state legislation and stuff, or at the national level? I guess, in most states, it's kind of clear who's going to win, right? I mean, how many states are there where there's much point in putting a lot of political muscle into what happens now in the state legislature? Aren't like 90% of the states kind of done deals, basically?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think they've sorted out that completely. I would assume, in California, it's a done deal.
New York, New Jersey.
One of the states where it used to be a done deal against abortion was Pennsylvania. Is Pennsylvania still firmly anti-abortion? I don't know. Is Florida up in the air? Is it Florida is definitely anti-abortion? I'm not sure. There's still a whole bunch of states where I think they'll fight it out, and those are the states where, where there's a political fight. Obviously, in a red state, it's going to be probably a done deal, but it will help the Democrats erode the Republican margin.
I guess, but like Virginia, for example. It's not totally clear to me why. I mean, for example, to the extent that it's framed as a national issue, and the Democrats say, hey, if we win big enough in the midterms, we can actually change this at the level of federal legislation. I don't know if they're going to try to say that. You'd have to kill the filibuster, and you'd have to have a majority even without Joe Manchin and so on. But if they make that claim, it's not even clear to me that claim, to the extent that it becomes salient, energizes the Democrats any more than the Republicans. That'll totally freak the Republicans out. They'll be campaigning 24/7 to get people to sign up to vote. I mean, it's not so obvious to me that this helps the Democrats. I don't know.
It's an interesting question. I guess my attitude, and it could be wrong, is that the first Roe is generally popular, 55-45. People like the in effect legislation that Roe set up. They're probably a little more conservative. They have a few more restrictions than the court would apply. But the Democrats are 100% pro-choice, and the Republicans are sort of split. If you're a Republican and you're pro-choice, you haven't had to speak up because the court has handled the issue for you. You don't have to deal with it. You can let the pro-life people run rampant, take over the party, and once it starts sort of hurting them electorally, I think there'll be some pushback in the Republican Party, and the Republicans will be split. So I'm not sure that 100% of Republican parties will go gung-ho and freak out and start registering voters. They're pretty gung-ho already.
Yeah, I'm noticing that.
So, I still think it's a mild boost for the Democrats, who are the despondent, party that's looking at a low turnout. And so anything that gets them out the door and organizing is probably good for them, but uh-huh. I hewed basically to the original New Republic position, which is it's a gift to the Democrats, just not now.
Yeah.
I have one more point about Alito, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure I would have published it. Somebody had given me this. I mean, Josh Gerstein, who got the scoop, is a really good reporter. Everybody respects him. He's not doctrinaire. He's probably a liberal, but he's very fair, very knowledgeable. He's a great guy. He speaks with authority. But if I got a hold of the thing, what good does it serve to publish this thing? I mean, it doesn't.
Oh, are reporters supposed to ask themselves that question? I mean,
I think so. They don't.
Well, they're supposed to, in areas of national security, at least there's a tradition of newspapers being willing to consult with the Pentagon before they publish something they get their hands on. I'm not aware of a precedent where something outside of the realm of national security is given that kind of treatment. I don't know.
There are people who come with scandals all the time, at least they used to, and the press decides this isn't worth it.
But, well, would you have done what Ben Smith did and published the, what was it called? The thing that included the PK
ballot.
Yeah, the dossier, Steele dossier.
Yes.
You would have published that.
Yeah, because
that had more, arguably fabricated defamatory shit in it than, it had that.
But at the point that Ben published that, the fantasies about what the dossier said were so much more lurid and damaging than the reality.
Yeah.
Publishing it revealed to the world what a piece of shit it was. So I think he actually did a public service. Although lately it's turned out that did have more repercussions in terms of letting the FBI do things than I thought it had. But I still think it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, more and more.
There are cases where the Times, even recent cases where the Times has not published things at the Pentagon's request. The Pentagon Papers would not be one of them. That obviously should be published. But
so
you have to make an independent moral decision, is all I'm saying.
Yeah. By the way, on that issue, on the whole kind of Russiagate issue, one thing I hadn't realized, and I think this is a pretty recent development, this Mark Sussman guy has actually been indicted for being, like a lawyer for Hillary and so on for the Democrats, and going in and telling the FBI about the Steele dossier, I guess. And what he's indicted for is claiming to the FBI that he was not working on behalf of any interested parties like Hillary Clinton, when he was actually apparently billing them for the time he spent talking to the FBI. It had kind of had a hearsay-ish quality, because there were no contemporaneous notes. In other words, the FBI agent he talked to, who was an old friend of his, he wasn't going through the standard conduits because he was so well connected. He went like kind of pretty close, right to not quite the top, but pretty high up. That guy went in after the conversation and told another FBI guy what he had said, and that guy wrote it down. So, however, it has come out recently, and I only caught up with this recently, at least, that Sussman texted this guy the night before. Apparently, this is now widely believed to be true, at least saying I'm not coming in on behalf of. So they've got, apparently they have the lie just stone cold. Okay. And I didn't realize that before.
That's a very good point. The FBI has this whole tradition of not taping interviews and just relying on their notes, which seems incredibly fishy to me.
But these were secondhand, after the fact.
Right. These were even worse than that. Right.
But it sounds like that's not going to be a problem. The other thing related to this is, I think, last week I was characterizing a podcast I had heard. It was a conversation between this libertarian Scott Horton and somebody who is equally suspicious of the whole Russiagate thing, and they conjectured that Jake Sullivan was running the whole Hillary Russiagate thing. And I think I made it sound like that had been a mainly after the election thing in hopes of getting Trump impeached. But I said that. Well, no, I was under.
Okay.
They definitely said something to that effect. But what they meant was the campaign persisted after the election, because then the hope became that Trump could be impeached. But the heart of it, I just actually looked at the dates, and it's like in September of the election year that Sussman comes in, I believe, if I've got this right, and talks. Anyway, it's before the election. This thing is a pretty serious campaign emanating from the Clinton campaign or Democratic circles, apparently, to amp up this, Trump as a Manchurian candidate thing. And that, I think that's what these guys were talking about when they surmised that it must have been a Jake Sullivan, and a sheer surmise on their point, it's conjecture, but they were saying this is a sophisticated campaign. Only one man could have handled this, and that's Jake Sullivan in their view. Anyway, I just wanted to correct
that. Glenn Simpson seems to have done a pretty good job of spreading it on his own, right?
He was like two levels down. I mean, you know, that's the point, is that this was a multi-level thing. I mean, he was what? He was fusion or what? Well, what was he?
I mean, he had all the reporter contacts. He's an ex-Wall Street Journal reporter, good friend of Mike Isikoff,
yeah,
and other reporters. And he employed the wife of a major FBI official. How many more contacts do you need?
Yeah, but I mean, first of all, the Hillary campaign employed him, right? I mean, he's not where this started. He's not.
They just needed to hire Glenn Simpson.
Right. But it's not like he had an idea, woke up in the middle of the night and said, let's do this. No, somebody contacted him and said, how about we pay you to do this?
He may actually, you know, he's a smart guy. Maybe he had the idea of, hey, I can shop this idea to Hillary. But,
well, yeah, because he had already been enlisted by a Republican Trump opponent, right? Is that right? Fusion GPS had started.
Started being employed by Peter Singer.
Right. Right.
Who was on behalf of the
rich guy.
On behalf of whatever the publication that Continetti publishes, I think, or maybe it was Ben Shapiro's. I forget. No, one of those right-wing publications.
I think you're right. It was Freedom, whatever, Freedom.
And then they dropped Beacon, it when Trump Beacon. Won the primary. Then the FBI picked it up for a while, and the FBI was paying them. And then the FBI got pissed off at Steele, I think, and stopped paying them, and then Hillary picked it up.
So anyway.
Anyway.
Watch that space. That could get a little more interesting.
Again, I must admit that I think probably people, you know, was it misinformation or disinformation? Well, it was disinformation because they sort of knew that it was bullshit. But I think they seriously were worried that Trump was in the pay of Putin, or somehow Putin had him by the balls. And
they probably
refused to say anything nasty about Putin.
They probably did. But so, I mean, look, if you were seriously interested in that Alpha Bank allegation about the mysterious data going back and forth to the Alpha Bank computer, you could have shown it to really top flight people. And I think they would have figured out this is bullshit.
Well, they did. And they said that.
They actually knew it was bullshit as they were selling the story to Frank Ford.
I think shortly thereafter. I think they knew it was bullshit. The FBI, I think it came out this week, they knew it was bullshit. People had told him it was bullshit before they decided to use it as the basis for, you know, going after Carter Page.
And by the way, and this is a good transition to Ukraine, because as I've said before, another thing I learned only a month or two ago is that, you know, it's widely thought that the Russians did the DNC hack. And I think the DNC hack was truly consequential. I think some emails came out of that were really bad for the Hillary campaign. It was just relentless. It was just like every day for a while. And
The Bernie Sanders stuff?
There was just a lot of different stuff. There was some Clinton Foundation stuff. There was Sanders stuff. It was just something different every day. And the liberal media was so sure that Hillary was going to win, they just had fun with it, right?
Right.
But it turns out the government has never, as I understand it, our government has never actually looked into whether that was the Russians. And the conclusion that it did depends on a finding by CrowdStrike, which is this company that I don't know much about, except I know the transition to Ukraine, which is that I think it's this Dmitry Alperovitz guy, right? He's a CrowdStrike. I think he's maybe the founder. So anyway, I'll Google this to make sure I haven't completely misled us. But he's become a big figure because he knows so much about Russia. He's become a big source on Ukraine.
And he's Ukrainian?
I don't think so. I think he may be, I don't know. It may be Russian. Let's see. He runs something called the Silverado Policy Accelerator, which is like a really smart way of branding what is, I suppose, in some sense, just a think tank. But it's like the cool new, you know, it's like when New America Foundation changed its name to New America, that was like movement toward, that was an arrow pointing to Silverado Policy Accelerator.
I guess accelerator is better than incubator.
Oh, totally. That's the difference between the Silicon Valley Dimitri and the Washington Dimitri is incubator versus accelerator.
How about a policy disruptor?
That's what you need.
A policy weaponizer.
We should start that. A policy disruptor. American policy could use some disruption.
I got to start a policy pouncer. We're going to pounce on any policies we don't like.
So yeah, he's a CrowdStrike guy, and I think CrowdStrike did this finding. Anyway, that leads us to Ukraine.
But CrowdStrike techies aren't actually in Ukraine. I know there's a lot of very smart, computer people in Ukraine.
And so, yeah, I don't know anything about that at all. It's a very tenuous segue we just did to Ukraine.
Okay.
But he's a Ukraine guy, and he does this. Silverado, I think, started a podcast, you know, for the Ukraine war. They run these his interviews, his almost weekly interviews with Michael Kaufman, one of these Ukraine stars, an expert on the Russian military. Well, so I don't know, what's your take on Ukraine?
You know, I was gonna ask for your takes, as you probably have read more. What I thought was weird was this article in the New York Times about why has Putin showed so much restraint? And they couldn't answer it.
Restraint in the sense of not wiping out more infrastructure?
Yes.
Because he is starting to do that now, just in
he's
time
starting to
from
do
his
that,
point
but,
of
yeah,
view.
But maybe he read the article.
That was probably it. He probably read it. He picked up his daily New York Times and said, yeah, it's a good question. Let's wipe out some shit.
I mean, yes, he hadn't destroyed nearly as much as we thought he was capable of, or we think he's capable of.
Well, if you mean infrastructure, he's been going after that. I think he hasn't done nearly the damage to cities, broadly speaking, that he could if he wanted to. And that's one thing I think we should keep in mind as we decide whether to try to wrap this thing up or just let it go on forever, which seems to be our policy now. If he gets desperate in the sense of thinking his regime is in danger because he's going to kind of lose the war, God only knows what could happen to Ukraine. But as for infrastructure, he did start recently hitting the rail, these power substations or something on the rails in Western Ukraine. I gather most Ukrainian trains are electric powered, not diesel. And that's pretty clearly because he fears that the wave of Western weapon systems coming Ukraine's way could turn the tide in Eastern Ukraine. And I'm sure that's having some effect. He's also wiping out fuel supplies. There is something of a fuel shortage in Ukraine. So he's certainly doing a certain amount of that stuff now.
He's a little late on the weapons, isn't he? I mean, haven't a lot of them gotten through?
I like all these howitzers.
Yeah.
I think a lot of those are still in Western Ukraine. I think it's only just now that they've gotten into the country at all. And those are big systems that you can't just stick in the back of a van. Whereas these things, like these switchblades. And by the way, there was the first sighting in the wild of a switchblade. I think actually Russians took a picture of a switchblade that had been fired. I don't know if it had misfired or if it's standard procedure that the base of the little rocket stays intact, and even if the warhead goes off and explodes. But anyway, that was around Kharkiv. And I think that could help account for some of the success the Ukrainians apparently enjoying around Kharkiv. I still need to find out a little more on exactly what its capabilities are, but it seems like in principle, a very important weapon.
I read somewhere, is it that drone or this other new drone that somebody else has that can actually hone in on specific people? So if you say we want to kill this general, it can sort of look around and when it sees the general, it goes and blows him up.
This doesn't have AI face ID on it, if that's what you mean. That would be kind of scary. But I'm sure we're headed there. What it has is a camera on it. So you fire it. And the small one that can't do a tank but can do other vehicles and can go a few miles, you can carry around in a backpack. It's really small. You fire it like a bottle rocket, and then the blades pop out after it leaves the tube, which is why they call. The wings pop out.
Right.
So that's why they call it a switchblade. That one, I mean, both of them, what they both have in common, the other one is bigger, you know, a strong person can carry it around, but it's bigger and it can go like 20 miles and blow up a tank. What they have in common is you know, once you fire them, you're seeing the, what they see through camera. You know, these are kamikazes or so-called right. loitering munitions. They don't come back. They just blow up. And you're watching on a camera. What's unclear to me from the descriptions I've seen is what you can definitely do is if they punched in like GPS coordinates and you see that, oh my God, it's a kindergarten, you can abort by after you see what it's going to hit on the camera. But what's not clear to me, and I assume is the case, is that you can just point to something and say, hit this while it's loitering. That would make it an extremely powerful weapon. I mean, especially the long range one right now, because I think one of the untold stories I'm starting to think is that the Ukrainians are getting hit a lot harder in the East than a lot of people realize. And they're losing more people because there's a huge asymmetry right now in artillery capacity. The howitzers, by and large, haven't gotten there. And the long switchblade is a kind of a substitute for a howitzer, except with more in the way of precision guidance. But right now there's two narratives in the East. The mainstream American narrative is, oh, the Russians, it's halting progress at best. The offensive has stalled, as the Washington Post put it yesterday. A few people are saying, and you're seeing a little of this in Western media, but not much, is that, you know, don't expect the Russians to move like a quarter of a mile a day. This isn't the way they do it. They stand off and completely barrage you with artillery. It seems inefficient to us because a large majority of the shells don't hit anything, especially when what you're aiming for is a trench, right? All along that frontier. But over time, they're taking a big toll. And there was a piece in the New York Times kind of confirming that part of the narrative, which I've seen more prominently in kind of, you know, more less mainstream online sources.
But then eventually they have to send in troops and that's where they start losing.
Well, they do. But, you know, according to some of these accounts, you're talking about there's a point of demoralization beyond which taking the trenches is not hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I don't know where we are. But if you read yesterday's Times, there's an account of it seeming pretty grim. He interviews a couple of soldiers who have come back from the trenches. Yeah. They're in a hospital. Yep. So I don't know. You know, last week I said, well, if somehow Russia, you know, May 9th, this Monday, is this big victory day, huge day in Russia, huge military holiday. And I said, if somehow Russia took both Donetsk and Luhansk by then, they might say, okay, we won. Do you want to talk peace? That seems now it's clearly not going to happen. There are some people who are saying maybe the opposite will happen. There will be a general mobilization and a true declaration of war from Putin. That seems to not be the consensus view.
And which are you rooting for?
Rooting for? I'm just rooting for an early end to the war, but
there, I'm going off on this tweet from David Frum, mm-hmm. where Zelensky said Russia would have to withdraw to the pre-24th February positions as a minimum for any cessation of hostilities.
Right.
And Frum writes, bad news for those hoping to deliver Putin a face-saving, quote, win, unquote.
I think he's right. I think he's right. I think Zelensky, that is a recipe for endless war, what Zelensky said.
But I would like to deliver Putin a face-saving win.
So yeah, me too. Putin,
like J.D. Vance, I don't care that much whether certain parts of the Donbas are part of Ukraine or part of Russia. As long as Ukraine stays an independent state, the borders don't bother me that much. And so if that can deliver Putin a face-saving win that ends the war before it gets out of hand, that's a good thing.
Well, see, I do care. As I've said, I think there's I would deeply regret giving any kind of positive reinforcement to an illegal invasion. But as I said last week, like if Putin, if this is like a loss for Putin, like he didn't gain anything through this war, then I think he sees that outcome as an existential threat to his regime. And at that point, who knows what? He wipes out city after city, maybe even nukes. Maybe who knows? All bets are off. It goes on forever, for one thing. I mean, look, do you realize what Zelensky is saying here? I mean, it's funny. Zelensky actually said two things. He was talking to Chatham House. And one thing he said is, we can see no end to this war and we see no willingness on the part of Russians to end it. And now Zelensky's position is the one from stated, which is that apparently we can't even have a ceasefire. We can't even talk peace seriously until Russia withdraws from all the territory they've gained in this war, which is a lot of territory, like Mariupol. Mickey, do you see Russia after the drama you've seen in Mariupol saying, oh, well, never mind?
I assume that this is a negotiating position for Zelensky. If a ceasefire actually was, there was a prospect of it, he might soften that.
The
interesting thing to me was Trump's position, which seemed wrong, which is we don't want Putin to have a face-saving victory that he can use to end the war, even if it's an obviously trivial and cosmetic face-saving victory.
This is classic neocon. And I think it's more or less the neocon position with this war, but it's classic neocon.
It drew a clear line between the neocons and me. I'm happy to be against the neocons. I just didn't quite know why sometimes. But that is why. I listened to, is it Joseph Cirincione?
Yeah. He was on my podcast a few weeks ago.
I didn't know he was on your podcast. I listened to him on Bill Press's podcast. Scott McConnell.
My podcast.
Well, the Bill Press one, he tweeted out, this must have been before he was on you. He said, start here and you'll only spend 10 minutes listening to me talk about how nuclear war ramps up. And the one thing, and it is very good. He talks about the five stages of the five possible scenarios, starting with Russia sets off a demonstration bomb to, you know, the two parties are lobbing nukes at each other with ICBMs. It seems there was no reason why Putin would not do a demonstration strike. The inhibition on that seems very minimal. And so there's a huge risk of that happening.
Wait, why is the inhibition so minimal? I mean, that's a major threshold to cross.
Because he said our reaction would be to sit tight and protest at the UN. We're not going to do anything. If he does we don't retaliate. We don't blow up whichever place set off the nuke, we just sit back and take it.
Well, that's not a matter of U.S. doctrine. We haven't said that, and it would be very unwise to say it. You should at least leave Putin uncertain as to whether there would be nuclear retaliation.
I don't think it's a matter of U.S. doctrine. It's a matter of a guy who's incredibly familiar with U.S. doctrine, saying that's what would happen.
So if Putin
listens to Bill Press's podcast, maybe your podcast too, then he sets up a demonstration nuke.
It is not American policy to rule out nuclear retaliation. It isn't even American policy to rule out first use of a nuke. Okay,
I understand, but you understand my point.
If Putin thinks that makes it more likely. Yeah,
it's more. It seems like way more than a 1% chance.
Oh yeah, and look, you know, I want to say something. I mean, we have both fretted a little about this morphing into nuclear war and saying, you know, if this war goes on for months and months, that just every week there's a chance, it increases the chances. Now, you know what's going to happen if there isn't a nuclear war, which it probably won't be. People will say, you know, you said there was going to be. I'm not saying that. I'm saying if you do something that increases the chances of nuclear war happening this year from 1% to 2%, that is criminal irresponsibility. Okay, this is nuclear fucking war.
Hang on there. Somebody at the door. Hang on.
Okay.
Hello? Hang on, I guess I'll come right back.
Huh, wonder if I should try to entertain you. I just reached this stirring crescendo. I don't know if I have any energy left. I just said nuclear fucking war. I gotta go take a nap. That took a lot out of me. Let's see, is there anything else I can say about this while Mickey's gone, or will we have to cut it out? High drama moment. Oh, I know what I'll say is that, no, I wanna say that to Mickey, but... you know, again, I'm serious, like, you know, nuclear war, it's like, you know, the concept of expected return in economics, like, you know, so if like you're a Silicon Valley investor and if this company succeeds, it'll make you $10 billion. But there's only a 10% chance of success, then the expected return is $1 billion. Okay. It's percentage time, you know, chances of it happening times magnitude of outcome. So when you're talking nuclear war, expected, you know, loss, you know, 1% times, if you imagine a war when in which, you know, like 100 million people are going to die, you know, in this kind of utilitarian theory, Mickey, I had to freelance while you were gone.
That's okay. It was somebody running for city treasurer of Beverly Hills.
Huh. Did you vow to vote for them?
No, I said I'm taping a podcast, and he was very apologetic.
Was it the candidate himself?
I think it was the candidate himself.
Oh, Mickey, and you just brushed him off?
I think it was a dark horse. I think that
if it was a dark horse,
treasurer is a shoo-in.
You should have asked him. You should have said, are you just a dark horse? Anyway, they got my point. I think I was just saying that, you know, you should think about nuclear war the way you think about expected return in finance, you know, like an investment's expected return is the money you get if it works times the percentage chance that it'll work. And it's the same thing in reverse with nuclear war.
So, it's like a reverse Pascal's wager.
Kind of, I guess. So anyway,
why not exactly?
Nuclear war bad, folks. And, you know, the last thing I want to say about Ukraine is I was listening to another podcast with this David McGregor guy, you know, this guy who's controversial. He was in the Trump administration. He's a colonel. I will say he's definitely a smart guy. Seems knowledgeable. He played a big role in formulating some sort of Pentagon doctrine about how to fight the Russians, I think. He's definitely smarter than a lot of these generals you see on cable TV. Okay. This guy's smarter than Wesley Clark, with all due respect to Wesley Clark. He says he thinks that the Russians still plan to go for Odessa and Kharkiv, and he thinks they'll do it. He thinks they can do it. This was a fairly recently taped thing. He says, don't be fooled by, you know, the information you're getting through Western media that they want to do it, they can do it. And as I understood him, they will do it. I mean, people can judge for themselves. That's also on this Scott Horton podcast. So something to worry about, I guess, is that the Russians might not settle even for what they've got or what they'll have in a couple of weeks or whatever.
Huh.
Cause for concern.
So all the hopes that Putin will declare victory and push for peace after this Monday holiday commemorating the victory over Germany, they're all falling apart now, right? Nobody thinks that's going
to happen. Well, he'll claim, I mean, it'll definitely be interesting to hear what he says. He'll claim some kind of victory. I think he, you know, one reason they're pushing on the, you know, trying to get those last people out of the steel factory, you know, in Mariupol is that he'd like to be able to declare victory there, because remember, this is like a big chunk of the Azov Brigade. So he can say, I told you this was about denazification for one thing. We got the heart of the Nazis, you know? I mean, he could say that.
So they get the civilians out of there and then he drops a nuclear bomb on the Nazis? That would happen?
No, I mean, my impression is they're starting to go underground. You get conflicting reports. It's like one moment the Russian troops are going underground after these guys. Next moment, they're going to evacuate some more civilians. I don't know what's going on. I know he'd love to have that part cleaned up by Monday. And, you know, look, he will say he can look. They have acquired a lot of land. I'm sorry to say it, but they really, you know, they got the land bridge from Crimea and, you know, they still have a lot of territory around Kharkiv. And so he can say that there are a lot more Russian speaking. Well, it was the land occupied by Russian speaking people who are no longer, as he would put it, you know, threatened by the anti-Russian Ukrainian forces. Of course, the truth is a lot of those people have left because of the war, have evacuated toward in one direction or another. But he can say that kind of stuff.
The question is, does he then sue for peace? does he then will accept a ceasefire? And I don't think so.
To me, it seems like his gains are not consolidated enough, specifically in those two republics that he recognized, right? He still doesn't control all of those, Luhansk and Donetsk. It seems to me his gains aren't consolidated enough to say, okay, I'm done and mean it. Can we, and say, can we just talk peace? You know, on the other hand, you got all of these weapons coming in from the West. And if he, you know, he knows better than we do whether, for example, these switchblades are starting to have an effect. Something's working about around Kharkiv. And so if he fears that enough, who knows? I don't know. I'm certainly not going to try to predict this.
Okay. We've all turned into Hugh Seide, Bob.
Time will tell, Mickey.
Time will tell. Why am I paying you to come on every week and say only time will tell?
Are you paying me?
There was a no. There was shit. I was assuming the voice of Martin Agronsky in Kinsley's parody of Agronsky and Company. saying, Hugh, do you have a brain at all?
That was one of the original shout fests, Agronsky and Company. Followed, I guess, by McLaughlin Group. I guess
it was so much better than what we have today. I mean, because
it was pretty good, actually. I mean,
entertaining bunch of people with different points of view.
Actually, kind of. I mean, loaded. McLaughlin was loaded so that the liberal, you know, it's kind of a Hannity Combs thing. I mean, Eleanor's Cliff job was to lose arguments, basically, but still, it was like one liberal and three
Buchanan
conservatives.
Was migrating horseshoe style to the left on trade
and war. So we're at 55 minutes.
We're at 55 minutes. Well, I have a
quickly.
We haven't talked about the number one story in terms of, well, it's the number two story in terms of what gets hits on Twitter that I've tweeted about.
What is
which
it?
Is the Taylor Lorenz blow up.
Remind me.
You haven't. It's a completely minor thing, but it reflects something, which is she tweeted that a guy from Drudge Report was claiming to be an editor at Drudge Report, was harassing her, was going to destroy her career. Then Drudge called her up and said, "That's bullshit. You know, nobody from Drudge Report is calling you up." And she then tweeted, instead of saying, "I apologize to Drudge Report. I made a mistake. I should have checked it out before I wrote that." She said, she tweeted, I just thought it was hilarious. I didn't even know Drudge Report still existed. And she didn't really apologize. And you think, what kind of fucking teenager is this? I mean, you own it. You own your mistake. It's a little mistake. It's a trivial mistake. And it's over.
Well, maybe she's not owning her mistake. Maybe she's not, doesn't think she was wrong.
Well, her drama, she's a drama queen, and her whole point of existing is to have these dramas where she never admits she's wrong. And when she's caught out in being wrong, she stages a new drama where she says, "Oh, haha, it was all so hilarious." And I don't quite know why the Washington Post tolerates it. I mean, are there no grown-ups at the Washington Post who expect people to behave like adults? It's weird. And she also blocks you. Anytime you tweet this, you're instantly blocked.
Wait, who is this? Did this thing start with the Libs of TikTok thing, or am I confused?
This is a woman who outed the Libs of TikTok thing. Yeah, well, that's her whole career.
And who is this woman? I don't know shit, man.
She's some young journalist whose career is outing.
Oh, she's a journalist.
Outing conservatives and as if it's a crime to be a conservative. I mean,
does she write for the Washington Post?
She does now. She previously, I think, wrote for the New York Times.
Oh, yeah. Well, then we do hold her to a higher standard. So whatever standard I was holding her to before you told me that, I'm holding her to a higher one now. And God damn it, I demand results.
Okay.
So quick pandemic news. It's a big study out of Harvard and elsewhere, apparently showing, settling this issue, like why did Omicron seem milder in its effect, less likely to get you hospitalized and killed? Was it inherently milder, or just that it was hitting populations that had more natural immunity and more vax immunity than earlier, the answer seems to be the second one. It, according to this study, it is not intrinsically milder. So if you haven't had COVID and haven't been vaxxed, be careful, because we have a whole new wave of it, of course, and a whole new Omicron hitting the East Coast anyway, where I am.
That's distressing. But so what happens is each new wave hits you and it actually infects you. But because you're vaccinated, you eventually fight it off and don't die.
It's probably a combination. Probably some people fight it off so fast they don't. They aren't strictly speaking infected, or it doesn't cross the infection threshold. Some people get infected but not sick. But the point is that the mildness was a product of the population being prepared for it. It's not compared to the original COVID virus. It's not milder inherently.
So this idea that this happens to all flus, that they get milder and milder and milder, and eventually we don't notice them, is wholly dependent on the vaccine. It doesn't happen naturally.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, with flus, I'm sure there's a lot of built-up immunity because a lot of people get the flu every year, leave aside the vaccine. But I don't know. I don't know. All I can do is tell people to Google Omicron mild Harvard. They want to see this latest study.
I do that every morning.
I don't doubt it.
It's part of right before my cardio workout.
What is your exercise regime? Well, we can talk about that in the parrot room. Can I do two quick corrections, Mickey? One is I just discovered that it's not Alperovitz, it's Alperovitch, this Dimitri CrowdStrike Alpera guy.
Bob, I went through the entire last episode saying Club of Rome when I meant Club for Growth.
There is a Club of Rome.
What?
There is a Club of Rome.
There is a Club of Rome, but it's not the Club for Growth.
But it's also conservative, right?
I think so. Yeah. But that gave me new sympathy for Joe Biden getting the occasional name wrong.
When I was a newspaper reporter, this is back before the internet, folks, you couldn't just check shit. And I mean, I could have gone into the physical archives of the newspaper while I was writing this story. In retrospect, should have. This was a woman involved in local school board stuff. Her first name was Portia. I can now report that her name is not, in fact, spelled like the car Portia. I wish I had known that when I wrote the story. I didn't. Who knew? I was young. I was overworked. We wrote multiple stories per night.
Man. So, you try to buy a Porsche today, they definitely demand a pound of flesh.
Good transition.
What was your second thing?
Some weeks ago, I felt guilty about this night after night. I was talking about going to college, and I said my parents weren't, they weren't the kind of like, you know, they were like, tell us when you decided what college to go to. That's not accurate at all. What's true is that they were not, they did care. They paid a lot of attention. They just weren't schooled in the landscape of elite colleges. There was just no expectation that I would, that if you did well in high school, the point would be to go to some kind of prestige school. That's all. That's different. My parents loved me, Mickey.
That is different.
It is.
I felt better of your parents.
You should. There's no such thing as thinking too well of my parents. Believe me, wonderful people. So, what are we going to talk about?
Everybody agreed it's insane. Everybody except Jack Schaefer agrees it's insane for U.S. officials to go around boasting about how they've given intelligence to Ukraine that let them kill Russian generals.
Totally.
I mean, even Richard Haas. Everybody from Richard Haas on to the, less neocon,
right,
and less blobby. Then today's leak was insane.
Today's leak was, we also helped them blow up that ship,
right?
Now the fine print is, well, we didn't really say it. You know, it was just we were doing general intelligence sharing. But no, this goes up there with Biden saying we want regime change and Lloyd Austin saying we want to weaken Russia. It just is all. It's like if Putin just dictated his dream narrative support from the U.S., all these things would be it. This is what he wants to tell the Russian people. And this sustained support for his war effort.
Why are they doing this? Suspect number one is politics. Biden is facing a grim midterm, and he wants to get out the idea that we're doing great things in Ukraine.
Yeah, in fact, he visited a Stinger? No, it was a Javelin factory.
Right.
A Lockheed factory where they make javelins, like And I guess the connection is that he wants people to know we're providing jobs by sending money to Ukraine. But like, also like, is this why we're doing this? Like, that would be a bad motivation, right? Just to make, you know, to keep Lockheed going. And if we can do that by killing Russians, I don't know.
I had missed that, but I think most people accept he's doing a pretty good job on Ukraine, president company excluded maybe, and he's not getting any bounce from it. So, you know, convincing people more that he's doing a good job in Ukraine ain't going to do him any good.
It's a mystery to me why the administration seems to think this is a big political winner. They're just watching too much MSNBC. Stop it. Let's adjourn to the Parrot Room at patreon.com/parrotroom.
Things to say. Have you said both of them? Yes, you did.
Yeah, those are my two corrections about my parents and about Dimitri.
Okay. There are a couple of Elon Musk things. One of them is related to Epstein.
I've got an Elon Musk thing.
So there's that. He announced his investors. Not all of them completely kosher.
You're right about that. I have a version of that that may be different from yours.
Okay, you probably do. We've both watched the show Station 11.
Well, we've watched the first two episodes, and we'll discuss that.
We have things to say.
And I have started the show Severance, which I may try to lure you into watching for subsequent discussion.
Might not be hard to lure me away from Station 11.
Well, we'll talk about that.
There is a point to make about the latest July 6th leak. We had an Oath Keeper talking to a Trump aide.
July 6th or January 6th?
January 6th, sorry. July 6th is my birthday.
Is it?
It's very, oh, great. Also, so I can George do, like, W. Bush's birthday.
That's half of what I need to do identity theft. Thank you, Mickey.
Really?
Yeah. Shit. You want us to delete that?
That was just disinformation. It is true that an incredible number of things just ask for your birthday. And like, why is that a bit, why is that any?
One of the wisest things I ever did was when I first signed up with Facebook, I was like, I don't think I'm going to tell you the truth about when my birthday is. As a result, no one knows when my birthday is. It's wrong on Wikipedia because they got that from Facebook apparently. And I ain't telling you when it really is, folks. And there's, by the way, big demand for that information, Mickey. I get phone calls and letters all day. So what else are we going to talk about? So Station 11, Severance. Oh, Mickey, I got like the classic Michael McFaul brush off. Okay. I challenged him to come on my podcast on Twitter. He DMs me his response and you're not going to believe how great it is. This is so McFaul. Try to imagine the McFaulest thing in the world, folks. You won't get there.
I thought the line on McFaul is he shows great bravado in his sort of regular conversations. When it actually comes down to making policy, he's shockingly reasonable.
Well, when it comes to debating Bob, he's shockingly chicken, if you ask me. But that's was not it, the story. The story
was
is
it worse
how
than
he
my
handled-
response when I didn't debate Ezra Klein?
No, that was a little more pathetic, frankly. And that's a pretty high threshold.
But more macho.
Oh no, he handled the, that was the beauty of his brush off.
All right.
It was really a thing of beauty.
There's a White House correspondence dinner. There's Gavin Newsom pretending he's a presidential candidate.
Consortium News has been deplatformed by PayPal, at least kicked off the PayPal platform. What's going on, folks?
What is Consortium News? You can
explain. It's this like left wing, but you know, not crazy. It was started by a very reputable, I think, journalist named something Perry, who died, and
Robert Perry.
Yeah, and there's related stuff, and then there's an account, a Twitter account, got banned for. I'm going to talk about all this for Ukraine related stuff.
So this is all pro-Ukraine, a pro-Ukraine.
I assume Consortium News is being taken that way. They've definitely done some good work, you know, over the years.
There's your colleague Nikita is now rousing rabble in Armenia.
Oh, is he? You can fill me in. I'll have a word with that boy.
He tweeted a photo of an Armenian anti-government rally saying people in Armenia don't like their government.
And, so?
Well, he's a guest there. They've offered him refuge from Putin's agents, and here he goes and starts fomenting unrest.
But, I'll have a word with him. One thing I definitely want to talk about. We can talk about that. But one thing I definitely want to talk about is this podcast, Dead End, put out by WNYC. It's about a murder that happened just a few miles from my house in 2014. I may have talked to you about it. It immediately aroused suspicion, could ultimately reach into some fairly high levels of New Jersey politics. Fascinating case to me, at least. I want to talk about that. And what an apparently corrupt state New Jersey is. I want to talk about that.
Stop the presses. Isn't that a little dog bites man? Yeah.
Well, but that's what's interesting about this. This scandal has been on simmer. Why were these people killed? Why did the county prosecutor not do a very good job of investigating? It's a very prominent New Jersey Politico guy who was killed. I want to talk about it. He had been Secretary of Transportation under Tom Kane. He was like a total. There was at his funeral. Okay, there were two former governors and a sitting governor at his funeral.
Okay. You're not leaving it in the locker room.
There's more.
Okay. I have a couple more things to say about Roe versus Wade and sort of more substantive, less political.
Okay. We got plenty. Plenty.
Okay.
Wonderful. A veritable smorgasbord. A veritable cornucopia.
I will go...
Find the parrot.
So
Patreon. Yeah. Patreon.com/parrot room, where you will see more from the parrot you're about to see if Mickey shows you the parrot.
Me and this parrot?
That's the one I had in mind. See you in the parrot room.